All right, we were talking about homeotic genes, which are important in development. They code for proteins that then act at DNA to control other genes, to turn them on or off. That's how they influence development. And they are particularly important in determining what features develop in which parts of an animal, for instance. And slide 24 really is kind of just a curiosity. These HOX genes that are being shown here, these HOX genes are important animal homeotic genes. So they are examples of homeotic genes. And of course they occur on the DNA, just like any other gene would. But for some reason, HOX genes are situated along a chromosome corresponding to the spacing along the animal of the features that these HOX genes control. Which, that's kind of weird, because all the cells in the entire animal have the entire chromosome. Why would the spacing of the genes matter along the length of the chromosome? And I'm not sure anyone knows that. That's why I say it's just a curiosity. Anyway, let's go to 25. And we have we've talked about genomic control. We've talked about transcriptional control. The rest of the chapter has to do with post-transcriptional control in one way or another. Now, post-transcriptional simply means after transcription occurs. So there's all kinds of different ways to control gene expression after transcription. They're all lumped together as post-transcriptional. It doesn't necessarily mean immediately after transcription. But in 25, we're looking at an example that is pretty much immediately after transcription. This has to do with IgM, which stands for immunoglobulin M, which is a type of antibody. Antibodies are immunoglobulins. And we've already talked about antibodies a little bit in here. What's happening here, though, is that the same antibody can be produced in two different forms. In one form, it includes a little bit more amino acids. It's a slightly bigger protein, and therefore stays bound to the plasma membrane of the white blood cell that produces the antibody. White blood cells come in various forms. There are B cells, T cells, so on, plasma cells, different kinds of white blood cells. Some white blood cells produce antibodies and keep them in their plasma membranes, like you see here. And so to do that, they need to make the antibody version that has that extra bit of protein so that it can be anchored in the plasma membrane. Others secrete the antibodies so that those antibodies are just on their own in the blood plasma. They're not attached to a cell. And so that's what you see on the right. The reason they're able to be secreted is because they don't have that extra bit of protein, that extra sequence of amino acids, that would cause them to hang on to the plasma membrane. They get fully secreted. But as far as their operation in terms of their recognizing antigens, which is what the Y part of the shape here is about, that's identical. Remember I said before that we can make millions of different antibodies just with single genes because of the shuffling? Well, that shuffling is genomic control. And that determines the specific type of antibody with respect to its ability to recognize an antigen. That's not what we're talking about here. That's already been determined. But when the cell is able to produce its particular type of antibody that recognizes one type of antigen, it can produce that antibody in two different forms. One that it can hang around in its plasma membrane and one that can be secreted. And the way it does that is through post-transcriptional control, specifically through alternative splicing, alternative mRNA splicing, like we've already talked about. So the reason that the non-secreted antibody, the membrane-bound antibody, has that extra length of amino acids is because those exons get included in that alternative splicing. Whereas in the secreted version, those exons are treated as introns and they get spliced out by the spliceosome. All right. The rest of it, though, the functional part of it with respect to recognition of the antibody is identical in both. That's post-transcriptional control because you make the mRNA first and then you process it differently with the spliceosome. Okay, 26. Here's an example using iron. Let me just start over. There's messenger RNA here, notice. And so, once again, this is post-transcriptional. The messenger RNA has already been produced. Transcription is over. But in this particular example is a messenger RNA from a gene that codes for a protein called ferritin. Ferritin is a protein that acts as a storage for iron. Cells don't want iron by itself hanging around because it interferes with things. It's reactive. So it's stored by conjugating it or sticking it on to proteins. Ferritin is the major protein within cells that holds on to iron so that if iron is needed by other cells later, it can be released. All right? Well, this is the mRNA that codes for that ferritin protein. Since ferritin's job is to bind to iron, to hold on to it for storage, it wouldn't make sense for the cell to spend the energy to make ferritin, the protein, if there were no iron to hold on to. Right? That would be a waste. It would be like making a key for a lock that doesn't exist. So this messenger RNA, even though it has already been transcribed, is not necessarily going to be translated. Only if it's translated will the cell spend the energy to make the ferritin, right? That can be prevented if there's no use in making it. Well, part of the messenger RNA is this little loop called an iron response element. The iron response element is recognizable by and can bind to what is called an IRE binding protein. So the IRE itself, the iron response element, is messenger RNA sequence. The IRE binding protein is a protein that's able to recognize that IRE and bind to it. If that happens, then that is not going to allow for translation to occur. It's going to interfere with the initiation of translation. The ribosome is not going to be able to come there and bind. And therefore, that messenger RNA will not be translated. And therefore, the ferritin will not be produced. It keeps the translation off. All right? Well, IRE binding protein is able to bind to this IRE only if it itself is not bound to iron. So IRE binding protein is operating as a sensor for the presence of iron. And if there is plenty of iron, which would signal the need for ferritin to store that iron, then the iron will bind to the IRE binding protein, causing it, of course, to change its shape. Now its shape is not right for it to be able to bind to the iron response element of the messenger RNA, and it won't. And therefore, that messenger RNA will be translated, and you'll make the ferritin, only under the situation that you need it, though. 27. This one also involves iron, but for a totally different reason. And these are just examples. It's not always iron that's important here. In this case, we have a messenger RNA that binds for what's called a transferrin receptor. Transferrin is also involved in iron. Ferritin and transferrin both get their name because ferrous means of iron, right? Having to do with iron, which is why it's Fe. Anyway, transferrin receptors are proteins in the membrane of cells that are able to bind as a ligand, transferrin, a different protein, as a way of endocytosing iron. Okay, so remember I said that ferritin in a cell stores the iron? When it needs to give that iron up, because no more is coming into the body, when it needs to give it up to cells, for instance, cells that will become red blood cells that use a lot of iron, it needs to release it so that the other cell can take it up. When it gets released by the cell that was storing it in ferritin, it gets hooked on to another protein that gets carried around in the blood called transferrin. The transferrin then is carrying the iron, and it's going to be endocytosed by the cell that actually needs the iron. In order to do that, it uses receptor-mediated endocytosis. And receptor-mediated endocytosis, of course, involves a receptor responding to the presence of a ligand. And only then does it endocytose, right? In this case, transferrin is the ligand that is able to be recognized by the transferrin receptor, okay, on the surface of the cell that needs the iron. And when that happens, the transferrin is carrying the iron, it gets endocytosed, and now that cell has the iron. This is the messenger RNA that codes for that receptor, not for transferrin, but for the transferrin receptor. All right? Once again, you have an iron response element, just like before, but it's doing a totally different thing here. The iron response element is at the other end of the messenger RNA, so it does not control whether translation occurs. It's at the end of the line, not the beginning. All right? But if the iron response element binding protein, IRE binding protein, the purple one here, is bound to the IRE in this case, then it prevents degradative enzymes from chopping the messenger RNA up into bits. Okay? So think about how this happens. Now if you don't have iron, this is a cell that needs the iron, right? If it doesn't have iron, then there's no iron bound to the IRE binding protein. And therefore, IRE binding protein binds to the IRE. And that prevents the enzymes from chopping the messenger RNA up into bits so that the messenger RNA hangs around and continues to be translated, making more and more transferrin receptor protein so that it does a good job of receiving as much iron as possible endocytotically from the blood. Does that all make sense? If, on the other hand, that cell has already received plenty of iron, then that iron is going to start binding to the IRE binding protein, disabling it from binding to the IRE, the response element itself on messenger RNA, and that's going to allow the degradative enzymes to do their job of destroying the messenger RNA, and therefore you don't make any more receptor protein because you don't need any more iron. So, not only is this a specific example, but it illustrates just the basic idea that another way that cells exercise control of gene expression is to not allow messenger RNA to hang around very long. A typical messenger RNA could last for minutes or maybe hours, but that's it. It gets destroyed eventually, because you don't want to continue making the protein beyond the time at which that protein is necessary. It's okay that you destroy the messenger RNA, right? Because you always have the gene originally to go back to and make more through transcription. 28. Here we're looking at something that evolved probably as a way for organisms to respond to viral attack. Some viri use double-stranded RNA as their nucleic acid. Most organisms use single-stranded RNA, right? But RNA can be double-stranded for the same reason that DNA is, right? It can complementarily bind. The point is, though, an organism that uses single-stranded messenger RNA having double-stranded RNA in it all of a sudden should tell that organism something's wrong here. This is not your own RNA. You're being attacked. So what evolved is what's called small interfering RNA, siRNA, which is sometimes also called silencing RNA. But the SI stands for small interfering, because it does interfere with the process of gene expression. What's happening here is that Dicer, which is a protein complex, will respond to the presence of a double-stranded RNA in an organism that shouldn't have it there by chopping it up, basically, into smaller bits, which is what siRNA is. Okay? siRNA is a small sequence of RNA made from this original longer double-stranded RNA. Then, next in the process, is that a RISC complex, which are proteins also, come by. And RISC is an acronym that stands for RNA-induced silencing complex. All right? The RISC is just the proteins. But the proteins come along and bind to the siRNA. So now you have an siRISC, a small interfering RNA-induced silencing complex. That's the RNA plus the proteins. Okay? Now, one of those two strands just gets broken up into little bits and recycled for nucleic acids. To build new nucleic acids. The other one is still part of the siRISC. And the RNA part of that siRISC is now essentially operating as a probe, searching for a sequence that's complementary to itself in the RNA of that cell. And if it finds a complementary match, it tells the cell, well, this is RNA that really should not be here. Therefore, do not let this RNA be translated. Does that make sense? Well, if there's a perfect match, what usually happens is that the RNA that's recognized perfectly gets destroyed. If there's only a partial match, then it really just interferes with the translation rather than destroying the messenger RNA outright. But that's a protective mechanism, right, for invasion of foreign RNA. In 29, we can see that what has also evolved is a very similar mechanism, but instead of being a response to invasion of foreign RNA, it's a way to control a cell's own DNA and RNA. And so this is not called small interfering RNA, this is called microRNA, miRNA. So be careful when you read. mRNA and miRNA are not the same thing at all. And an I is a small letter, so look for it. That's not a hint that it's going to be on my test that way. I'm just saying this in life, preparing you for life. All right, microRNA is part of that organism to begin with. It's not foreign, like I said. So microRNA is coded for by genes, just like any RNA is in an organism, right? So in the nucleus, there are genes on chromosomes coding for microRNA, but it's an indirect process. The RNA that gets built from transcription of those microRNA genes is not the final version. It is called primary microRNA, PRIMIRNA, and that's bigger than it needs to be. So a protein complex, shown in blue here, cleaves within the nucleus, that primary microRNA, into pre-miRNA. So it's still not done, but it's now smaller than the primary. And the pre-microRNA is now small enough to be exported out of the nucleus, where it then encounters another protein complex, the same one that we looked at before, this Dicer one, that will cleave it again to produce the actual microRNA. Now, the microRNA then gets, and here's where it's very similar. The microRNA gets complexed with a RISC, an RNA-induced silencing complex, except now, since it's microRNA rather than small interfering RNA, we call this an MI RISC, not an SI RISC. But it basically operates the same way. It will bind to RNA either perfectly or imperfectly, and thereby destroy the RNA, the messenger RNA, or keep it from being translated. It can actually also go back and interfere with DNA. An MI RISC can go back and look for DNA that's complementary to it, which can also be then turned off. It can be methylated. Remember, methylation of DNA affects its transcription, and it can actually lead to chromatin remodeling. But the operation of the microRNA itself is post-transcriptional, even though it can lead to genome-level control. Its own control is post-transcriptional. Okay, now to 30. And I said before that post-transcriptional includes anything after transcription. Well, translation is after transcription, right? So post-transcriptional control also includes anything that interferes with translation or anything after translation. So anything that happens post-translationally is also post-transcriptional, right? Because of the order in which things happen. And examples of post-translational control would be something that interferes with two subunits that have already been translated, interferes with them coming together to form a multimeric protein, right? That would be post-translational control, an example. But also, just like messenger RNAs are not allowed to last forever, proteins themselves are not allowed to last forever. Now, some proteins just basically wear out. They become chemically modified accidentally and therefore lose their function. But in any case, proteins eventually get degraded intentionally by the cell. And to degrade a protein actually involves other proteins to do that job. One of which is called ubiquitin. Ubiquitin is a protein that acts as a flag marking other proteins for destruction. So we call such a protein that's marked with ubiquitin a ubiquitolated protein. The process of putting a ubiquitin onto a protein is ubiquitolation. All right? Ubiquitin gets its name because it's found everywhere. All cells use it, basically. That's ubiquitous means found everywhere. But that's two proteins. The protein that's being destroyed plus the ubiquitin is another protein, but there are other proteins involved as well, as we see here. So actually, ubiquitin doesn't directly bind to proteins by itself. It first binds to E1, which transfers it to E2, and then to E3. The whole complex allows it to bind to a protein. Then the E's, which are themselves proteins, get removed. More ubiquitin gets added, and that flags the protein for destruction. So that's several proteins involved. And then finally, once you have it successfully flagged, the major machine, molecular machine in the cell itself that does the destruction, called a proteasome, is a big protein complex itself. So you stuff this flagged protein for destruction into the core of a proteasome, so-called, it literally means a body of proteases. Proteases are enzymes that degrade proteins, right? So once it's in the interior of this kind of can-shaped proteasome, then the ubiquitolated protein gets digested into amino acids. Shorter peptides, which can then be further digested into amino acids. But the point is that protein is no longer doing its job, and that really is also a form of gene expression, because anything that interferes with the process all the way from DNA to a working protein is gene expression. That's the chapter.